68% of all Americans, I'm told, believe in the existence of angels. I'm not one of them, but I rather wish I were. But, of course, by angels, I don't mean those banal beings who loiter listlessly on clouds, playing harps, translucent and bored. That's what happens when you can't eat, smoke, or kiss girls. No, God forgive me, I never want to be one of them. Give me a short, sharp shock of damnation any time, something bracing and sexy. What I want to believe in is the angels of the poets. In John Donne's Angel with Wings of Air, William Blake's perky friend, the angel in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, Byron's angels, hoarse with singing out of tune, Yeats's great angels who visit us in our hours of need, Eliot's dark angel. Because when we peruse the imaginative world of writers, it appears that without their angels, they are as nothing. I wish I could have some, even one, just to rescue me from the mundane linearity of my mind, its relentless prosiness. Such angels, the angels of the poets, are an emblem of translucent otherness, of the ideal towards which the imagination strives, yet which is only just imaginable. Artists want the company of angels in order to escape from the confines of the merely rational. Consider, for instance, the lines from John Keats's Lamia. Philosophy will clip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air and gnomed mine, unweave a rainbow. And if I had to choose the one philosophical text that most clearly and powerfully exemplifies the hostility of philosophy to poetry, it would be A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic. Though it was published in 1936, the text maintains its capacity to shock. Indeed, one of my reasons for wishing to go to Oxford was that I would have a chance to hear Ayer lecture. He was a controversialist. He loved to argue, and he was a very formidable opponent. What he opposed were those metaphysical concepts and statements that he called nonsense, and those further propositions, like those of ethics or aesthetics, which he regarded as simply emotive and consequently impossible to verify, and in effect, therefore, further forms of nonsense. God is good. Turner is a wonderful painter. It's better to do good than evil. Steak and kidney pie is delicious. One finds contentment in nature. Shakespeare is the best writer. These are not truths. All are nonsense of one sort or another. It made it quite impossible to be English without embarrassing oneself philosophically. I was persuaded by Ayer for some time at much the same age at which he'd written and published his book. He seemed so daring and so assured and so difficult to follow that he must have been right. But rereading it after many years, the book feels facile and dated, and it's easy to see how it engendered the parodies in both Beyond the Fringe and Monty Python's Flying Circus. But even so, one has to find a way to reject one's inner Ayer without throwing skeptical babies out with positivist bathwater. Because skepticism, properly understood, is a defining quality of intelligence. Its free working is essential to democratic culture, and education, as opposed to indoctrination, is quite impossible without it. But you certainly don't need to label a good deal of man's deepest and best beliefs nonsense to prove yourself a skeptic. You have to be skeptical about your skepticism. Let's turn to literature, though. Great works of literature contain and convey truths. And if the processes needed to understand them are different from those of philosophy, they're truths nonetheless. They're not nonsense. Otherwise, it would be impossible to learn from literature, which certainly contradicts one's constant sense of being enlarged in relishing Donne, suffering through King Lear, or smiling at the modulated ironies of Jane Austen. The truths one is exposed to through such reading are not simple ones and are often, sadly, transmitted by sloppy readers as if they were truisms. Gather your rosebuds while you may. Be kind to your daughters, even when they're difficult. Make a good and sensible marriage. These are truths of a banal but universal sort, and we do not need our great writers to remind us of them, only to make them glow. As George Eliot observed, the angels come to visit us, and we only know them when they're gone. It is the obligation of both poet and novelist to invite them back, and you don't find any of them in Language, Truth, and Logic. So, goodbye, Freddie Eyre. It didn't turn out that way, not quite, because being infected by radical skepticism is rather like contracting malaria. You may seem to get over it, but it recurs unexpectedly. I'd experienced a decade of partial remission when I had a renewed outbreak of the fever, and it wasn't difficult for me to locate the cause. It was called by various names, but if I say post-structuralism, you may recognize what I mean. That term is a generic one, and there's no adequate single definition. You want to know what post-structuralism is? It's him and her and this and that. And if writers like Lacan and Derrida didn't themselves have imperialist ambitions, their followers at university certainly did. These crusaders invaded English departments around the world, uncombatibly aggressive, grimacing weirdly, anxious to conquer and to convert. Alas, alas, over a period of years beginning in the late 1970s, my best and brightest students were increasingly influenced by continental linguists, philosophers, and psychoanalysts whose approach to literature, if they distinguished the literary from other forms of what they called signification, had absolutely nothing of the painstaking particularity that I associate with good reading. But in spite of all post-structuralist arguments to the contrary, the reader is not the maker of what he experiences. He is subjected to his author. He's imposed upon, invaded, possessed. The reader hears the voices, is totally exposed to the characters of a novel, and has no control over their presence or absence. You can't simply put a book down or away. Books are peculiarly adhesive. A throng of characters clamorously demand attention. Voices rise and fall, fade in and out of our consciousness. We suspend the everyday, ignore the telephone and the doorbell, eat with our eyes fixed to the page, overcome, ravaged by the demands of the text. It's no wonder that writers, who are, after all, the best readers, claim that books provide them with the best of friends. Dickens refers to the friendships we form with books, and Charles Lamb regarded books as the best of company. I suppose I did have some things in common with old Freddie Eyre. Like him, I'd never got on with metaphysics. What the hell is time, or being, or indeed nothingness? And worse than that, who cares? It wasn't that I wasn't interested exactly, I was. How can a teacher not be interested in material that excites his best students? No, the problem was not a question of interest, it was a question of taste. I hated it. I hated it as in loathed and detested. Hated, as in A.J. Eyre, dismissively, contemptuously, nonsense. What a useful concept to revert to. What a terrific rejoinder. I slipped seamlessly into default mode back to the ludicrously self-assured, judgmental self of my high school years. I had the perfectly annoying habit at 17 of lifting my index finger into the air and announcing, while in discussion or argument, either false, left finger, or true, right finger. I thought of the fingers as Holden Caulfield, left finger, and Allen Ginsberg, right finger, and believed that they provided sufficient guidance to make my way through my emotional and intellectual life. I thought of these inward voices and their finger manifestations as opposites. I had need of both, of the capacity to distinguish the phony from the true, to be both skeptical and enthusiastic, and it did not occur to me, curiously and stupidly, that my Holden and my Allen were manifestations of the same impulse. Both were outsiders, both keen to subvert established values, unable to enter into a community of like-minded fellowship. It was on the basis of such inward counsel, am I tempted to say alas, that I came to live in a foreign culture, to marry a woman maximally different from me, to choose a profession in which I was uncomfortable, to make of myself even more of an outsider, and to derive what comfort and amusement I could by observing the distance between my inner world and my surroundings. Though I am now a dual citizen, both American and English, I'm also neither, and I now feel equally uncomfortable in both cultures, except on those days when I don't. When I finally came to locate a voice in which I was comfortable writing, I found that whatever my apparent subject, my real subject was me, observing myself, indulging the discomforting ironies of a displaced person. And nothing has made me feel more alienated, more out of place, more an outsider than this post-structuralist stuff. My students and their teachers, who were given over to the new material, had begun to behave like members of a secret society. They not only talked a different language, their faces registered varieties of self-satisfaction and scorn usually reserved for Scientologists. The jargon was appalling and has been nicely described by V.S. Naipaul as a way for one clown to tell the other that he's in the club. If you want to join the club, you have to correlate this new form of language to its essential form of life. Get yourself a table and some companions in Paris. Go to the De Magot. Drink a lot of espresso, smoke gitan, talk all night, shrug and wave your hands about, purge all specificity and observation from your vocabulary, and replace it with abstraction. Close your eyes, philosophize, and it will all make sense in a way quite inconceivable in a senior common room at an English university. I resigned from the Department of English at Warwick in 1984. It would, I suppose, be inaccurate to claim that I'd been pushed aside by the alien hordes. In fact, I'd wanted to leave almost from the very moment I got there. And by the early 1980s, it had become clear to me, as I rose every morning, that it was becoming increasingly easy to distinguish work from pleasure. Becoming a university teacher had been a bad choice based on insufficient self-knowledge. The life I chose wasn't zappy enough, nor was it ever likely to accommodate the rackety nervous energy that has always characterized me, nor the subversiveness, nor the need to play. I'd been seduced into going on with my studies by the mere fact that I was good at them. But the proof, finally, of the academic pudding is in the writing. I generally liked teaching of that certain sort that kept its critical eye strictly on the text, but you can't go on doing that forever. The only activity that defines a true academic, and that only included a small percentage of my colleagues, was the ongoing passion to do literary research, to write a new account of Dryden, or to investigate the link between the English and the French Romantics. And you have to do more than want to pursue such topics, you have to need to. And that never made any sense to me at all. Need to write a book about D.H. Lawrence? No, I had to, because the institution required it. William James once observed that for a serious thinker, there are only two possible imperatives, either seek truth or avoid error. As a younger man, I'd been greatly influenced by truth seekers, by William Blake, Walt Whitman, Allen Ginsberg, say, but I had insufficient self-confidence to write with any such freedom. No angels, you could put it that way. To be a truth seeker, the imperative implicitly is be like Nietzsche, in which case you have to actually be like him to have something to say, something new and urgent, and I didn't. And I still don't. That's a good lesson to learn young. It saves you looking a considerable fool. Avoiding error was the safer trail for me. I remained a skeptic, though not a radical one. I wasn't a radical anything. You can shed your air without finding your angels. So you play it safe. Most academics do that. The work that they produce is generally worthy, well-researched, competently presented. And if most such work is fundamentally uninteresting, even those of my colleagues in the same field as me didn't read my work, nor I theirs, it is at least not wrong. When I announced my early retirement, I was 39 at the time, a kindly colleague slipped into my office, closed the door carefully, and whispered, "I just want to say that I think it's very brave of you, what you're doing." I knew what he meant. I had two young children, and my income as a part-time book dealer was just over £5,000 a year at the time, or roughly a third of my salary as a senior lecturer. I was giving up the security of a tenured position. It was a risk, leaving. So what? At least it would get me out of an environment in which I felt increasingly crimped, where I'd never found my own voice as a writer, and had long ago ceased to have any fun. "I must say," I replied to my colleague, "that when I think of another 30 years in this department, I think it's very brave of you to stay."